Welcome to the West Highland Way Race Podcasts. I'm John Kinsden, and this is episode 70. Welcome back to the West Highland Way Race Podcasts. It's now Tuesday, the 9th of December, and just a couple of days ago, in fact, yesterday, Ian put on Facebook and on the West Highland Way Race website, and also contacted people about the update from the ballot. And Ian wrote, "We have now considered all the entry applications for the 2015 West Highland Way Race. There were 370 applications in total. Of those, 6 withdrew from consideration prior to the review process. 24 were not considered to have adequate relevant experience at this stage, and their application was rejected. That meant there were 340 qualified entrants for 265 places, so a ballot was needed to determine the 75 people who would not be given a place in this year's race or next year's race. The list of the 265 is on the website, and they've all been told now. And in the next few days, each of these people will receive an invitation to enter the race via SI entries. This needs to be done, accepted by the 31st of December 2014. Any places not accepted by then will be offered to people who have been unsuccessful in the ballot." So it's the first time we've had that many having to miss out this year, but the race will be there next year and the year after. And so if you didn't get a place this time, then hopefully you'll get a chance in future years. And there's, I think the difference now as well is lots of other races around that people can do if they can't get into the West Highland Way Race this year. This podcast, I've just finished an interview with Mike Raffin, and that'll be coming up now. Mike's had a great year this year, involved in lots of different races, which we talked about. So I hope you enjoyed the interview that's coming with Mike. Right, tonight for our podcast, for this episode, I've got Mike Raffin on the other side of the screen. So welcome, Mike.
Hi.
And Mike was in the news a lot over the weekend, and I know a lot of people were following his progress on the hill, and I'd like to start with that one. But just a little bit of background for Mike. He's been running ultras since 2010, and he started off with the D33, is that right? That was your local race. And I seem to remember running with you or in the same races, the Fling and the Catterin that year. And I remember you were behind me, and you were not a middle of the road runner, but you were certainly a little bit slower than you were. And then in 2011, it all seemed to change. And then the next time I saw you, you were up at the top end of the races. And since then, you've certainly been at the sharp end of a lot of races that you've done. You've ran the West Highland Way Race 3 times. Each year you've got almost an hour or over an hour faster. So in 2011 it was 21:30, 2012 it was 19:24, and then in 2013 it was 18:18:22 for 6th place. So there's been a great progression there over the last 4 years, so it'll be fascinating to find out just how that's gone. But I thought, instead of starting with how you got into ultras, I thought we'd start tonight, Mike, with finding out a bit about this hill race that maybe a lot of people listening to this will have been following. But for those who know nothing about it, can you just tell us in a nutshell what the hill race is all about?
Well, I think nut is the right word for it. It's an interesting race for sure. If you don't like hill reps, then you won't like this race. It's basically just under a mile and a half up a single hill and then back down to the same point again. Repeat 55 times in total, so you get total mileage of 160 miles. The Mark Cockbean organises the event and he sets the rules. They're simple. You're not allowed any outside support other than from the actual race crew. And that is, you only get that from the point at the bottom of the hill. If you stop for more than 30 minutes, you're disqualified, because he says it's a running race, not a resting race. Mm. So, like, people would go in with the tactics of running for a bit, resting for a couple of hours, but you're not allowed any of that. You have to be constantly moving. So at the bottom of the hill, there's a camper van where they'll provide basic rations. You can also have your own food there. And then inside the pub at the bottom of the hill, you've got your kit bag. So you can go into the pub and warm up. But I tried not to, because if you go in, you don't want to come back out again.
Now, it's fair to say, isn't it, Mike, that to get a place on this race, you have to have done at least one, if not two, 100-mile races.
Yeah, to apply for it, you've got to have done at least one 100-miler, and then they decide whether that 100-miler's good enough, and then they invite you to be part of the race.
Right, yeah. And last year, was the first year last year? And out of 20-odd starters, only one person actually completed it. That was John Steele.
Yeah.
So that just shows how tough it was. So there just tell us a little bit about your approach to it then.
Well, I saw it last year, and I was tempted to do it, but something else came up, and I can't for the life of me remember what it was now. So it must have been on holiday or something like that. So John did it in... It had a 48-hour cut-off time, and he did it in 47 hours and 31 minutes. And I just had it in my head that, and I think a lot of people probably did, if John can do it, then why can't I? And it's probably not the right way to approach it. It's just because somebody else can do it, it doesn't mean to say that you've got the same qualities as they do. I'd actually not planned on doing it this year, because I did the UTMB back in August and came out of that thinking that was a really difficult race, but for different reasons than other races. Afterwards, I didn't feel like I'd been challenged in a running capacity. It was more the sort of endurance, and I was able to run within a week, because I think it was due to the hills in the UTMB were just too steep, too big, and you were forced to walk. So afterwards, I came out of the UTMB and I thought, well, do I want to do anything else? And I knew the hill was coming up, but I couldn't enter it because my wife's sister's getting married in America in a couple of weeks' time, but they hadn't set the date at that point, so we couldn't confirm when our flights were going to be. I actually only entered the hill with about 2 weeks to go.
That's very inconsiderate, isn't it?
I know.
So it was only 2 weeks before you entered?
Yeah.
Ah,
so
right.
It doesn't sound right to say it, but I hadn't really trained for the hill. I just happened to be in the right condition for it after UTMB.
Yeah.
And things align properly.
Right. Okay. Well, I've got some questions from Facebook, and I'll put them in at different places. And there's a few about the hill. James Stewart says, "What did you think about as you were doing the hill, especially in the latter stages, and was the mental battle harder than the physical one?"
I think it was. At the end of the race, physically, I knew it was finishing, but I knew that it was a 200-mile race, I probably could have continued. But mentally, it was definitely a mental battle. Going away from the checkpoint, knowing that you're going into the weather was -7 at one point, all conditions, visibility was down to all you could see was your feet.
Wow.
So it was... Getting back to the sort of things that you think of, I try to switch off, think of nothing. Later on in the night, when things got sort of really hard, probably you've been the first night, it was you started at 8 o'clock at night, and then you go through the darkness, and then you come through the light, and then you go through the darkness again.
Mm.
And it was then when I started to think I need to do something, and that's the only point where I really started thinking about things. And it was more like, what's my running form like? How far have I got to go? But that was the one thing that I didn't want to do. Because if you know how far you've got to go, then that puts you down.
Yeah. So each time you went up, were you counting the summits, or were you just trying to ignore that?
I was trying to ignore it. every time you go up, you dib your, like the West Ham way, you have a dibber. So every checkpoint, so at the top of the hill you dib the dibber, bottom of the hill you dib the dibber, just to prove that you've been there.
Okay.
And then they had a computer screen up at the dibber point at the bottom, and it told you where you were and when everybody checked in.
Mm.
So every lap I was able to say, right, this guy's so much behind me, this guy's so much behind me. The way I sort of approached the race was, at the start of the race, I tried to get a lead, and everybody says that I went out too fast, or they were during the race, but that was kind of my tactic. I did a good couple of laps, 20 hours worth.
Just say it quick, yeah.
Yeah. And then by then, I had at least a 2-lap lead at all points, and then all I had to do was keep that lead.
So in your mind, was it a race, or was it more the challenge of doing it 55 times? Did it bother you whether you're going to win it or not?
When I first thought about doing it, it was just to prove that I could do it.
Mm.
But no, I think I wanted to win it as well. And I think that's probably because of other races, how well this year's gone. So as soon as I entered, I wanted to win it.
So if the person who was second, if he was closer to you, would you have wanted to push a bit harder?
Yeah, definitely. I think I probably could have, but knowing that he wasn't pushing harder, and he was, I think he was slowing down more than I was, so I was able to keep it going.
Yeah, okay. Gary Mackay says, no questions, just a massive tip of the hat for this weekend. And I think a lot of people would certainly agree to that one. Andy Wilson says the hill with 5 question marks. So he's probably a bit concerned about your mental state, maybe.
I think I might be as well.
Yeah. David Hall, are you doing any hill reps this week, or has that put you off for life?
I don't think it's put me off for life, but no, I don't think I'll be doing any running at all this week.
Yeah. And then Rona, who's a good friend of yours, she has a few questions. One or two you've answered. But how did you approach the 160 miles mentally? You've spoken a little bit about that, but anything else you add to that?
I had to not think about it as if it was 160 miles. I was splitting the distances up into, it was laps. So each lap was almost 3 miles. But to be honest, the mile and a half up didn't feel like a mile and a half up, so you were able to convince yourself that it wasn't.
Yeah.
And then, so saying that you got 50 laps to go, it felt more like 50 miles. But another strange way of measuring it was, how many double marathons have you done yet?
Right. Yeah.
And that's a fling distance done, that's a West Ham away distance done.
Yeah.
What have I got left to do?
Right. So just to break it down, because it's not naturally broken down into sections, is it?
No. I know that you break down the West Highland Way into your 3-mile sections and stuff like that, whereas I don't do that. I usually go by checkpoints and know that there's about 7 miles between the checkpoints, and that's usually enough. But for this, it was sort of doing bigger measurements, and then within that, you have the smaller measurements.
Yeah. Ron also says, what was the lowest part or distance, and how did you get through it?
I don't think the distance really mattered. I think it was the time, and it was into the second night, probably about halfway through the second night, I was falling asleep on my feet.
Mm.
And the only reason I knew this was that, I felt like I was really, really tired, and I just wanted to go down and you were allowed to stop for 30 minutes, and I could have had a 20 minute sleep, but I know that being in the pub for 20 minutes, all warm, I just wouldn't have wanted to get out again. So no, I'm not allowing myself to do that.
Yeah. And the photos I saw of you were in shorts most of the time, is that right?
I was, yeah. I didn't, although it was minus, I think the coldest it ever was -7. It's probably -2 or -3 or -4 most of the time. But to be honest, I've been out in shorts in -15 before and not been that cold. I find as long as my hands are warm and my upper body's warm, then I'm okay.
Yeah. Excellent. She also says, did you have any cool hallucinations?
No, I'm annoyed with myself that I can say that I've never had any hallucinations that I would consider hallucinations in any race so far.
Right.
And maybe that's why I go into these races, I want to have this. But no, that I would say tricks of the eye, that's about the closest thing to hallucination I've got.
Right.
Where, like, I remember during the West Highland Way, you sort of look over and go, whoa, what's that? Oh, no, it's just a rock. And you think it's something else. But I wouldn't class that as a hallucination. That's just not seeing something properly.
Right.
And I know during the hill, there was one point in the race where you go up the hill and there's a shadow. And I always thought, why is there a black cat in the middle of the path? But it wasn't. It was the shadow. But it happened every time I went past it. So it must have just been the shadows in that particular shape. And then there was one bit where I looked down and I said, oh, there's a toad. I was like, no, it's not a toad. It's an upside down crab. Like, that made it any better. But no, it's not. It's just a weed. So it was just my eye playing tricks on me. I didn't see any pink elephants or anything like that.
Okay. And her last question is, what did you do and eat after the race had finished?
Pretty much. My friend Ian Duggan had kindly chauffeured me down so that he could take me back up the road again so I didn't have to drive. So we hung about until the second person finished. There was only three of us that managed to get to the end out of, I think it was 31 that signed up and 20-something started.
Mm-hmm.
So three people finished. We waited for the second person to finish. And then the next guy was going to be another 4 hours. So we had a long drive up to Aberdeen. So we just headed off. The first thing that I did was ate two packets of sugar. I could feel myself sort of being lightheaded, and I knew that's what it was. So we went into the bar and didn't bother with any drinks or anything like that. So two packets of sugar straight down, and felt much better afterwards. And then we headed up the road, got some food near Manchester, and then Ian was saying, he was about to say to me in the car, oh, do you want me to turn the music down so you can sleep? And I was already asleep before he even asked me.
Yeah.
I slept for an hour and a half, and then we stopped for food, and I didn't sleep the rest of the time until I got home. So
yeah.
I'd been up for, 6:30 on the Friday morning, all day Friday, all day Saturday, and until about, 6:30 at night on the Sunday night. And I slept for an hour and a half, and then I was awake again.
It's amazing what you can do, isn't it?
Yeah.
Okay, I've got a few more questions from Robert Kinnard. You've answered some of these, so I'll pick out the ones you haven't answered. He said, if you were to run the hill again, would you change your approach?
I would train for it for a start. So I'm not sure what I would do differently, but my training was basically UTMB was my training. So I think the hill reps that I did for UTMB were probably suitable for the same purpose. So I think my approach to the training would have been the same, and then the approach to the race was get in there, get a few laps done quick. I knew that I wanted to be in the lead, and also knew that the weather forecast was worse for the second day. So I wanted to get a good amount of miles in before the weather turned bad and slowed me down, because it wouldn't only slow me down, it slowed everybody down.
Yeah. I noticed that. I think you went through about halfway in just over 14 and a half hours, didn't you?
It was something like that, yeah.
Yeah.
I can't remember how many miles it was. I'd actually worked this out. It was 2/3 in some time, and then the next third took the same amount of time, or something like that.
Right. I must admit, I saw your trace on Strava today, and it looks great, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's just a load of spikes.
One big thick red line going up and down and up and down. Yeah. Robert also asked, did you take into account in your strategy that day and night time running? Was that an issue in the way that you planned it?
It was, but not that much. I've got quite a a good head torch, a LED lens or R7 or whatever it is, and it is good enough to be pretty bright for where you're seeing. So with my older head torches, I used to find running in the dark slowed me down, but with this one, it's like a floodlight at times.
Right.
So it works quite well.
Yeah. And that lasted the whole race, did it? The battery life?
Actually, no. Annoyingly. It lasted the first night, and then about halfway through the second night, I knew it was going to cut out, so I took a spare battery with me. It takes a rechargeable battery, but you can also put in AAA batteries as well.
Mm-hmm.
So I had them in my pocket ready to go, and then when I was halfway up one of the laps, it was pitch black, I was falling asleep on my feet, and I knew I was falling asleep on my feet because I was running along, and then I would suddenly kick a rock and go, how did I manage to get here? I was back there. And my head torch flashes if it's about to run out of battery.
Mm.
So the course was marked with glow sticks. So I stopped beside one of them, hid behind a wall because there was really bad sleet at that time. So I hid behind a wall, used a glow stick to open up my head torch to swap the batteries over. When you're exhausted in the pitch black, a glow stick is not a bright light to be able to see which way a battery is supposed to be around. So I eventually managed to get it in place. I think I put them in the wrong way around the first time, but eventually managed to get them in the second time. And then the second, or what I thought was the second place runner, turned out to be the third place runner, came up behind me just as I'd managed to do it. And I was going to say to him, can you shine your head torch there?
Yeah.
But I'd managed to do it. But him being there sort of sprung me into, I don't know if it was him being there sprung me into action or me concentrating on the head torch, it sort of mentally switched me back on again. And then from that point, I was wide awake and the race was on again.
Yeah, excellent. And the final question we've got on the hill is, Robert asked, have you got any tips on beard growing? I think your beard caused quite a bit of comment over the weekend.
Yeah, I was getting told that my friend Ian, he was telling me some of the Facebook updates, and apparently some of the first ones, during the first couple of hours, people go, oh, this guy's going out too fast, I don't know who he is.
Yeah.
And then later on it was, oh, don't know who he is, but he's got a beard and he's hardcore.
And he's Scottish.
Yeah.
That's what it was.
Somebody said, oh, he must have Northern spirit. No, he's a Scotsman.
Well, once again, Mike, congratulations from the West Highland Way Race family. We were all very proud of you. And
Thank you.
Anyone who's done any sort of running will know that a challenge like that is a tremendous effort, not only physically, but in a sense, maybe more so mentally, just having that resolve to be able to, as you say, to leave the checkpoint and go up and down and up and down 55 times. So well done from us. I'd just like to go back to 2010 then, okay? So your first race, the D33, and just tell us a little bit about your running background before that. Were you always a keen runner? And why did you want to take part in that race?
I started running probably, a year and a half before that, when a colleague from work was about to turn 40. He was having his midlife crisis. And he'd signed up to a 10K, and he wanted a group of us to sign up to the same 10K and do it with him. So I thought, oh yeah, I'll go and do that. And then after the race was finished, it was Loch Ness. They had the 10K and the marathon on at the same time.
Mm.
And a different colleague was doing the marathon at the same on that day. So he finished and said, oh, why don't you join me for Edinburgh Marathon in 6 months' time? Oh, all right, why not? And went and did Edinburgh Marathon in the spring of 2009, would it have been? And absolutely hated it. It was far too hot. It was the year where they ran out of water and people were fighting on the course over the water.
Oh, yeah.
And I got to the end of it and said, I'm never running again. And then George Reed, who, a good friend of mine, who organised D33. He was in the pub later on that night in Inverness, because Karen was doing Loch Ness that year, I think. Or was it? Yeah, I think it was that year. And then they told us about the Highland Fling. So they convinced us. It was me, Dave Morrow, I think, and I think Flip was there as well. And possibly Sandra? Can't remember. It was a long time ago. And they convinced us to enter the Highland Fling. And then later on that year, Sums was born, and the D33 was invented for Sums. So I couldn't not do George's race since he'd convinced me to do the fling. So it was done. And I probably didn't take the best approach to doing it. I 3 weeks before the D33, I did my first 40-mile training run, which I probably wouldn't advise for a newbie, but I thought it was the right thing to do at the time.
There's a question from Sandra. She said, Sandra McDougall, she said, I started running ultras around the same time as you, and I've watched you go from middle road plodder like me to, well, now. What changed? And how did you turn that around? Which obviously that'd be a question. I remember getting in touch with you that second year and asking what your secret was. And I think you told me beer, but I wasn't convinced by that. So just tell us a little bit about your approach after that first year, where Sandra said you were more of the middle of the pack. And then the following year, you were right up at the sharp end of races.
I think in the first couple of years, well, first year of ultras anyway, I was finding my feet. I didn't know what I was capable of. I was running just to see what I could do. And then I think the thing that changed between 1 year and the next was consistent running. The first year or so, I didn't follow a plan, and I was just running what I thought I needed to run rather than actually sitting down and saying, right, I do actually need to run this, I do need to run that. I know you work out with your 12 months in advance, you need to do your back-to-back runs. I wasn't doing anything like that. And I started running with my colleague, Dave Morrow, and he follows a rigid plan, have to do every run, and he was following a training program called HAD at the time, H-A-D-D, I think it is, and So I was training with him. We were training at heart rate, but not my heart rate. We were training at his heart rate because I was just running whatever he was running. But that made me be out there every day consistently running. So and I think that is the thing that improved me, made a massive jump. I also did the Markathon, which is on at the moment, 1 year. And being an ultra runner, you can't just do the marathon, you have to do it properly. And I did it every day for 100 days and averaging 10 miles a day. But I got to the end of that and thought, I'm running for the sake of ticking a box, doing numbers rather than actually enjoying it. So that's why I stopped at the 100 days. But I think that helped massively with the sort of, it got my fitness up, it got me into it, it made me realise what I needed to do.
Yeah. And I've got some questions later on, Mike, I'd like to ask you about some of those things, but if we could just maybe just think about the West Highland Way for a few minutes. As you know, the entries and the ballot was done over the weekend, and there's 265 people who've got a place, and sadly, just over 100 or so have missed out this year. But just tell us a little bit about your first West Highland Way in 2011. So that was the following year. As you say, you'd had that good markathon and that good 100 days of training. And your first one was 21 and a half hours. So tell us a little bit about how that first one went with your training and the actual race.
Let me just look up what I did during that year. Just looking at my races now. In 2010, I did D33, Fling, Kattering, Devil and Speyside. 2011... I pretty much did the same thing, but adding in the West Highland Way. So I was just learning from what I did before and adding in new things. I didn't think there was anything wrong with the 2010 year. I needed more consistency and I needed more miles, more training. And the goal always was the West Highland Way. And I think the races that I did afterwards, I probably didn't enter them until quite late on. Because I would recommend if West Highland Way is your A goal, then train for that and then forget about anything else afterwards.
And then the following year you went back and you took over an hour off. And then again the next year you took another hour off. So was that just a natural progression for you? Or did you change things for those 2 years?
I think they were just natural progressions. Throughout my training, one thing that I would say is there's a saying that it's always do what you've always done, always get what you've always got.
Hmm.
And that's what I apply to my training. If you just stick to what you've been doing the whole time, then you'll get the same results. So I try and look at this particular session helping me. If it's not, then don't do it. If it is, then should I do it more? Or should I do something else that's similar to it? And just adding new things in, taking away, and that's just sort of where I've got to. I'm not saying that the things that I do would be particularly perfect for everybody, but it's just finding out what works for you, changing them if they don't.
So maybe come on to this later, but have you got any, you know, particularly for the people who just are in the West Highland Way race for the first time, based on your own experience of running it three times, what sort of advice would you want to give to people at this stage? They've got the place now, they've got 6 months before the race. So any advice that you'd like to give to folks who are starting out on their journey?
Find your support crew and get a good one early and look after them.
Right.
They're the most important people of the weekend. As much as you think it's you, it's not, it's them. Because if they don't look after themselves, they're not going to look after you. So you've got to make sure that they know exactly what to do.
Yeah. Okay, thank you very much. And then just think about this year, Mike. I've got your, I don't know whether you've done any other races than this, but you did the D33 in March and you came second. The Highland Fling in April and you came ninth in a PB for yourself in 8 hours 10. And then you did the Double Catherine, 110 miles, which you won in just over 22 and a half hours. Then the Great Glen Way, which in July, which you won in 10 hours 48. And then you did the Lakeland 50, where you came 28th, and then the UTMB, where you finished 256th. So it's been a pretty good year, hasn't it?
Yeah, I'm quite happy with that, yeah.
So just want to pick out maybe one or two of those that have been, as you look back on this year, that you'd say have been your real highlights.
Well, at the start of the year, my A goal was the Double Catherine. The D33 and the Highland Fling were really just training runs for it. I wasn't concentrating on them at all. At the very start of the year, I put in quite a lot of speed work, so that was for the D33, but that was planned in that I would do speed work early and then concentrate on endurance after the D33, which led into the Fling and naturally onto the Double Catherine. And then the Great Glen Way, I hadn't entered that. I entered that, I think, a week before the race, the last possible moment before the entries closed, because I didn't want to enter it until after the Double Catherine, until I knew how I felt. So if the entries had closed, like, before the Double Catherine, I probably wouldn't have done the race. And then Lakeland 50, I did that because 2 years ago, I marshalled, so I had a free place, and I actually entered the 100 miles, but I dropped down to the 50, which you're not allowed to do. They say that you have to get your money back or however you do it and then enter again, but the only reason they allowed me to do it was because I qualified for the British Trail Running Championship, which was part of the 50 miler. So that's why they allowed me to drop down.
Okay.
So that was, I was treating that as a training run, just a nice day out in a course that I've never done before.
Yeah.
And just as well it was, because at the start of that race it was roasting hot and I just didn't really like it at all.
Right, yeah. And then the UTMB, I assume you've listened to the podcast I did with Dave, and we were chatting about his experience on the UTMB, and I think you saw each other a few times during that race, didn't you?
Yeah. Yeah, I was listening to Dave's podcast and I was just nodding my head at everything he said.
Mm.
It was, and he said the same for me. He read my blog and it was, yeah, totally agree with everything. It's fantastic race. Everything about it's great, but it's really, really hard.
Well, I just think the things that you've done this year with your double Caterham and the Great Glenway, and then just reading your blog and chatting to Dave, you obviously had some, you know, issues that you had to work through and your legs were trashed and you had to keep going, didn't you?
Yeah, it was a weird one. For the first sort of 50 miles, I was feeling fine. I was deliberately going slower, going down the hills, because I remember something that George said to me the first time that I did the West Highland Way was, don't go down Connacht Hill too fast because you'll wreck your quads and then won't be able to run by Kinlochleven.
Mm.
And I was, all the time, I was thinking that in my head. So for the first 50 miles, don't go down the hills too fast. But it came to about the 50 miles point and I thought, right, now I can, I don't need to save myself as much. There's still a long way to go. But I can push on a bit. And my head just wouldn't let my legs move. I don't know what it was,
yeah.
But looking back onto it now, I think it was, I wasn't eating enough, because the way that the race works out there, all the checkpoints, they have food provided for you, but I found it too repetitive.
Mm.
There was always cheese and salami, which is not something that I would particularly want in a race, and then they had energy bars and some fruit, but the fruit was cut up into tiny segments, so you had to take loads of it just to get enough energy in you. So at one point I was feeling really low, so I threw 10 sugar cubes into my bottle of water and I felt better afterwards. But by the time I got to the next checkpoint, it was obviously the way that the sugar works is you get a high and then you get a low again, so I had to do it again. I ended up having about 25 sugar cubes over about a 3-hour period.
Yeah.
Which is probably the equivalent of a bottle of Coke. But.
Well, it's certainly been a great year for you, Mike, and again, congratulations. Just wanted to think about a couple of issues, and first one is your training. And George Chambers also asked the same question. What sort of training regime does Mike have that allows him to recover in between races and be ready for the next one? So you've done 4 or 5 races this year and you've done well at each of them. So how have you peaked for those and recovered between them?
Most of them, well, up until the double Caterham, I had a set plan. Well, it wasn't set in stone. I tried to be very flexible with what I'm doing. If I don't feel 100% one day, then there's no point in pushing myself because I'll be even worse the next day. So I'll easily move my, if I had a 20 miler planned, move it to the next day or the next week, as long as I get. I was aiming for about 250 miles a month, which compared to the likes of, say, Paul Giblin or something like that, he's on about 400, 500 miles a month. And I know that I probably couldn't do that. Instead of doing the miles, I do, this year in particular, I've been doing cross training with weights and a little bit of swimming. So I think that's helped. Last year I did quite a lot of cycling, but I haven't really had time for it this year. Because whenever I've had the time that would have been cycling, I would prefer to be out running, because it was, to be faster at running, the best thing to do is run.
Have you got a typical week that you could just share with us? That you, what sort of runs would you do?
At the start of the year, I was, when I actually had it set out, it was usually a medium pace run on a Monday, I think it was, with a sort of recovery run. Tuesday morning would be a tempo session, probably about 8 miles. And then Tuesday evening would be a club session where we would do high intensity training, which I'm not sure I'd recommend doing both of them in one day, but it seemed to work. Wednesday was a recovery day. Either Thursday or Friday, depending on how I was feeling, was another tempo day. And then Saturday...
And are they all on the road?
Yeah. What I do is I go into work a bit earlier, and then I'm allowed to take a 2-hour lunch break or however long I need for the lunch break. As long as my work's done, I don't need to work sort of fixed hours.
Mm.
So the easiest thing for me to do is run down the beach at Aberdeen, which is all flat, all tarmac. And then on a Saturday, Sunday, I would try and get out in the Cairngorms or something like that.
Yeah.
And just varying distances between probably 20 and 40 miles.
Excellent. And the other thing I wanted to ask you a little bit about is your food and nutrition. We've had some runs together, and I've run with you watching you eat little bits of meat, and that's been the only thing that has kept you going for a race or a run or whatever.
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about how your nutrition and your food intake has changed over the last few years and where you're at now.
Originally, I was eating all sorts of things, like, I can't even remember. Sorin was a big thing that was I had at one point, especially the banana bread sorin. I really enjoyed the taste. So it was whatever I could eat, that's the thing. Whatever I could keep down and it provided enough energy, eat it. But over, as I say, learning from what you've done, adding in new things, does it work? No. I sort of evolved in what I was eating. And eventually, sometime last year, I started on what I thought was a low-carb diet, because everybody was doing it. It was a big thing. Some people did the paleo, but to be honest, they're all the sort of low-carb paleo things, they're the same thing. But I think what most people don't realise is that they're not doing a low-carb diet. I did a low-carb diet for about 2 weeks properly. And what it evolved into was a balanced diet. And it was, I had the same sort of things as what people would typically say is a low-carb diet, but I added in the starchy vegetables to get your carbohydrates, and then lots and lots of green veg. And I think that's probably the thing that's helped me most. Eating, like, they say get your 5 a day. No, it's probably more like 9 a day. I think I could easily eat half a kilo of frozen veg a day. And it's usually, I just plan out what I have and then chuck in the extra veg just to bulk it up a bit. But you're obviously getting your nutrients from that. But the other thing that I've learned is that was probably up until the end of last year, I was sort of doing that, evolving what I was eating. And then I contacted somebody that used to work at the university with me, who now owns a business called Food for Fitness. And he's a nutritionist. So, and he helps people in various different sports. There's Premier League footballers and stuff like that. So I got him to drop a nutrition plan for me. And one thing that I noticed straight away was I wasn't eating nearly enough to support what I was doing.
Right.
I was probably eating your typical 2,000, 2,500 calories a day, whereas now I'm up at 3,000. So it's just that much. And the extra, I've taken out certain things, like a lot of over-processed foods, and added in, not necessarily fresh vegetables, I don't know the sort of scientific bits behind it, but apparently frozen vegetables aren't that much worse than fresh vegetables. So for convenience sake, it's easier just to take them out of the freezer, shove them in the microwave, and they're ready to eat. So it's adding in more food and part of that a lot more nutritional vegetables.
Has your weight changed and the way you look from over that time?
My body composition probably has, but my actual weight itself hasn't. So I've lost a bit of body fat and added more muscle on, but my actual weight has stayed about the same.
Right. Okay. Well, interesting. And again, I'm sure people, when they listen to this, may want to talk to you more at other times about your food. The other area I'm interested in is your footwear and your gear, because again, we've had some conversations on our when we've ran together. And I know you're probably not a Hoka man, which is fine. but just tell us a little bit about your progression and the way you've thought about the footwear and the different things that you've used over the last few years.
Well, I started off by doing what everybody gets told to do, and I went to a running shop and got my gait analysed. And the people at the running shop said that I massively overpronate, so I should wear support shoes, and I should also put orthotics in them. And it felt great, right? I'll run in them. And that lasted about 200 miles. And then my knees started getting sore and couldn't work it out. And they said, with these shoes, you need to swap them every 400 miles, but you're only getting 200, so you need to swap them every 200 miles. And that was costing 70 quid a go. And I wasn't paying 70 quid.
No.
So I can't remember how I got onto it, but I went to a physio or something like that, and they told me my knee problems weren't actually knee problems, they were ITB problems. So, and I managed to work out it was because of the shoes, because whenever I changed the shoes, the problems went away. So it was like, okay, it's the cushioning. Well, if it's the cushioning that's going, how can I get around that? And the obvious thing was, well, take out the cushioning. So at that time, Born to Run was just came out, and minimal shoes were all the rage. So all right, I'll try them. Got a pair of Vibram Five Fingers, and my second run in them, I went out and did a 20 miler, which you shouldn't do, but they felt fine. They felt a lot more natural to me than any other shoe that I'd been wearing. What didn't feel natural was the hassle of getting them on and off. So I went from the Five Fingers, but I actually took a step back in the minimalist approach and went with F-Lights, which are quite minimal compared to Hokas or whatever, but compared to the Vibrams, they've still got a bit of cushioning. I think it's like 6 mil or so. So, but what I found with them is I could easily get 1,000 miles out of them. I was like, well, I can get 1,000 miles out of them without hurting me. That's not only better for my knees or ITB or whatever it was that was causing the problem, it's also better for my bank balance. So it was a no-brainer, really.
Yeah.
And then I think I found a pair of shoes that were on sale that were metal trail gloves, and I started wearing them, and they, glove is exactly the word for them. They just hugged your feet and they just felt perfect. And my first pair of them, they were still going, having been through the washing machine about 5 times, and 1,500 miles later.
Wow.
So, and they were still on my feet, but they were falling to bits eventually. So I think I've been through 3 pairs of them since, and so I would go back to them. But now, it's back to the evolving of the running again. I'm going back to a more, not cushioned, but what I find over the long runs is you do want a bit of support. So at the moment I'm going with the Salomon S-Lab Sense, I think they are, and nothing to do with the fact that Kilian Jornet won the UTMB 2 years ago wearing them. It's they were actually cheap on sports shoes or something like that, so it's a good enough reason for me to buy them. So I tried them, and that was the ones that I was wearing at the weekend, and they felt really comfortable after the race. I didn't take my shoes off the whole race, and I've got no blisters at all.
Wow.
So if I can get through that, then they're an okay shoe.
Yeah.
I did notice this morning that the tread is actually coming away from them, so So maybe contact Salmon and go, hey, they don't last this one run.
Oh, they're new, were they?
I think they'd done about 70 miles before in them.
Okay. Yeah, you'd expect a bit more than that, wouldn't you?
Yeah.
Excellent, thank you. Right, just got a few questions on Facebook now. These just be some random questions. Norrie McNeil, after the hill and his UTMB, what is he thinking in terms of race adventure for next year and the future?
Rest. I came out of UTMB thinking I wasn't challenged, so the hill was the next challenge. But now I'm sitting here, my legs feel like I wanted to feel after the UTMB. So I'm ready for a rest now. The only thing that I've signed up for next year is the single Caterham. I want to go back and have another go at that, because I had a lot of influence in the double Caterham actually existing. So I've been there, done that, and I would go back to it, but I also want to go back to the single again. And then the other one I've signed up for is the Glenmore 24. So that's the only things. And the only reason I've signed up to them is because things fill up so fast nowadays that you can't just leave it to the last minute for most of them.
Even though I'm sure if you wanted a place, they'd find a place for you.
Yeah, but you can't rely on that, because if you did that, it's not fair on everybody else.
Yeah, that's fair enough. Mayor McEwen also says, it's very early days, but would you go back again to the double Caterham, but you've mentioned that, and or the hill? And would you consider doing long races that involve hot weather, like Badwater, or the Spartathlon, or Barclay?
To answer the first part, the two races, yes and yes. Love them both. Can't recommend them enough. Great atmosphere at both. Great races.
Yeah.
Hot weather, it just doesn't suit me. Most of the races this year, I've ended up running topless because I'm too hot. And during the hill, it was, as I say, -4 or whatever, and I was wearing shorts. People said, how can you do it? It's just, I don't like the heat, I prefer cold.
Yeah.
So it just suits me better. So I'm not sure that I would do well in a race that is hot.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Fair enough. Amanda Hamilton, what's your favourite race ever and your favourite West Highland Way race memory?
My favourite race ever is probably the Caterham Trail. Not the one particular race, but just the race in general. Every year, it's just a great atmosphere. It's probably because I've got a lot of involvement in the, so I know George and Karen quite well, so it's just a great atmosphere.
Okay, and your favourite West Highland Way memory?
Other than just getting out and doing the training runs with people, that's what I love with these, not necessarily races, but just getting out and running. The actual race memory would be running, the first year I did the West Highland Way, running down the Glen Nevis, down the last hill, and I had Vicky Shanks, Tommy Robb, and Alan Stewart with me, and none of them could keep up. And having just done 94 miles by that point and still being able to outrun them, it felt pretty good.
Yeah. Excellent. David Meldrum, are your legs for sale?
Afraid not.
No. Rab Lee, out of Team Handsome, who's your favourite?
Well, I know that one of Team Handsome is a BrewDog shareholder, so it'll be that one.
Okay. I'm not sure that is, so. James Stewart. He says, talk about putting the poor guy in the spot, like having to choose between cheese and chocolate. Sarah Self, does he feel being clean-shaven for some of his races this year held him back?
Well, if you look at the races, the D33 and the Fling, I was clean-shaven for them and I didn't win them. So
right.
Maybe the evidence speaks for themselves.
Okay, so you need the beard. Sandra, I had a couple more questions. What was your favourite race so far? You said that one. But what about your least favourite? Have you got a race you've not really enjoyed?
I'm not sure. The race I didn't really enjoy was the Fling 2 years ago, because I made a mistake with, I think it was due to not taking on enough water in the first 20 miles. In fact, I didn't take on any water for the first 20 miles. My water bottle was at Balmaha, so I didn't get a drink until then. And then I had cramp. But rather than giving up, I treated it as a training run and ran with Ross Laurie instead and got him to the finish. So I didn't like the fact that I'd messed up. But I still enjoyed the race. I still made the best of it. The only other sort of race that I didn't like was the hassle that used to be involved with the devil. But now that that race director has been changed, taking over new leadership, I think the first thing that he announces is I'm going to get rid of all the stuff that people don't like, and it looks like he's done it. So.
Sandra also says, what's the best piece of advice that you could give to a new ultra runner?
The best piece of advice? Keep on changing stuff, probably. Always keep on evolving what you're doing.
Very good. Peter Duggan, now I think this is a question about you're supporting Rona for next year, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, because he says, will you be waiting at Altnefed with chips for Rona? And can I have them if I get there first?
Yeah, during my first Wet Island Way, Rona was one of my support crew. So that's probably what he's referring to. If we're anything like what my support crew were in the first, my first Wet Island Way, we'll still be in the cafe at the ski center. Well, I went through the ski centre and they were all having their lunch up in the cafe.
And they left you to your own devices.
Well, they weren't expecting me to be so quick. So.
Oh, it's all your fault, yeah.
Yeah, I ended up getting somebody else's support crew to go up to the cafe and go and get them and tell them to meet me later on.
Right, okay. But Peter also says, have you ever considered one of the big rounds like Ramsey or Rigby? He thinks it'd be right up your street. Is that anything you'd fancy doing?
Well, unbeknown to me, I do quite a lot of my training in the Cairngorms, and I did a run one day, and I got to the end of it, and I think it was Peter that actually said, oh, you've done like 70% of the Rigby round. Like, oh, did I? I didn't realise.
Okay.
So
I've never heard of the Rigby. Is that in the Cairngorms, is it?
Yeah, I think it's 18 peaks in the Cairngorms.
Okay.
And I've done like 14 of them. Just happened to have done them.
Right. Okay. Ian Minty, could you ever win the West Highland Way race? If so, what would you need to do to achieve this?
Never say never. If you don't believe that you can do it, then you can't do it. You go into the race, you've got to have some sort of confidence in yourself. It's anything can happen to the other runners on the day, just like it can happen to you. But if I went into the race and whoever was in the lead happened to have a fall, then that's not through any fault of my own, and you've just got to take advantage of it.
Yeah.
So never say never.
So watch this space, eh?
Yeah.
And then the last question is from Christina Schmidt. She's got a few questions. If you could design your own bespoke dream route for an ultra, where would it be?
I'm not entirely sure. I've actually passed quite a few ideas to George and Karen, but they've never taken me up on any of them, apart from I had a big involvement in the double Karen existing. One of the races I've suggested to them was similar to the hill. There's a forestry track in Aberdeen, which is, I think it's 2.2 miles up and then 2.2 miles down, and doing that was it six times, and it works out at about a couple of hundred meters over marathon distance, so we're going to call it the world's shortest ultra.
Right, okay.
One of the other ones was a loop of five Munros around Loch na Garr, and having the checkpoint in the car park at Loch Mick, and you go and do it Barclay style, where you have a book at the top of the Munro, and you rip out the page to prove that you've been there, and then you take it back to the car park, and then you do that five times. So the loop's 20 miles with five Munros in it, and then you do it until you've done the 100 miles.
Okay.
They don't seem too interested in that one.
Well, you'll have to set it up yourself then.
Yeah.
She also says, doing well in long ultras, does it take a certain mindset without which all physical ability would be futile?
I think you do, but I think you learn it, you gain it over time. I'm not sure if it learns the right... I think we're just... With doing the races, experiencing, you know what you have to do the next time.
Yeah. So learning from each race.
Yeah.
And our last question, are you always focused in an ultra, or do you sometimes allow your mind to wander and think about things that have nothing to do with the race?
Well, during my training, I think about other things all the time. And when I'm running with Dave, we do a very similar job at the university. So we often have what people would describe as work meetings while we're out running, and we chat about things. We solve all the problems.
Yeah.
As soon as we get back to the changing room, we've forgotten what we've said.
Yeah, you have to take a notepad with you.
Yeah.
Or a dictaphone.
During the races, I try to concentrate on what I'm doing there and then at the time. If you concentrate on other things, that slows you down. You're not concentrating where your feet are. You slip up. You just got to keep focused.
Yeah.
I think when described earlier during the hill, I was starting to fall asleep on my feet. One of the things that I was trying to do was sort of concentrate on my breathing, concentrate on my form, and that kind of woke me up because I had something to think about. When you're not thinking, you get more tired.
Definitely. Thank you. Right, just to finish with Mike, I'm just going to go whip through the quickfire questions. These are particularly your preference for the West Harland Way race, okay?
Yeah.
So, shoes, road or trail?
It depends on the weather. If it's dry, I would go with road shoes. If it was wet, trail shoes.
All right, okay. Your favourite food to keep you going?
Blueberries.
Okay, I thought you were going to say sugar lumps there. But yeah. Hydration pack or water bottle?
Water bottles. I used to run with a hydration pack, but it's definitely changed to water bottles now.
Yeah. And would you have water or an energy drink in that water bottle?
Water, usually.
Yeah. Salt tablets?
I do, but like Robbie Britton says, it's more because I'm afraid to stop.
Yeah. Do you run with a watch, a Garmin?
Suunto, never leave the house without it. I think I got my first Garmin about 2 weeks after I started running, and I've got every run recorded since then.
Well done, sir. Excellent. It's all on Strava, isn't it?
Yeah.
with your support crew, would you have one team or two teams?
Just the one.
Just the one.
During the double Catherine, my wife did the whole thing solo, and she knows me. She knows exactly what I have to do.
Yeah.
She can tell me what to do more than anybody else can. So.
Yeah. Have you got a favourite section of the West Harland Way race?
Probably Lochside, I think, because you've got to think about what you're doing.
Yeah. Do you run with music?
No, never.
No. Have you got a favourite mantra that you like to refer to keep you going?
Yeah, but I'm not sure you can say it on the podcast.
Okay. What thing do you look forward to most when you finish the West Harland Way?
Knowing that you're getting your goblet. You asked earlier what was my favourite memory. If it wasn't actually during the race, it's just the one thing that I remember about each time is going up and getting your goblet.
Yeah. I think that's award ceremony, prize giving, is just amazing, isn't it? I think it's one of the things that makes the West Highland Way Race quite unique, really.
Yeah, it is.
The fact that everybody, whether you're the first runner or the last runner, gets your moment to go up and get your goblets is very, very special, isn't it?
Yeah, a lot of races, you'll get your T-shirt and a medal, and it's in a plastic carrier bag, and, well, it doesn't mean anything, does it?
No.
You get your chance to be in the limelight.
Yeah, yeah. We've given a few tips, but one final tip for other runners?
Keep changing things.
Okay. Well, thank you so much, Mike. I know you're a busy man. You're off to your AGM tonight, aren't you, with your Cosmic Hill Runners, is it? Or what do you call it?
Cosmic Hill Bashers, yeah.
Hill Bashers, yeah. Because I see someone on Facebook said, I thought you were coming to our AGM. And you said you're doing both.
Yeah,
and then you're off to America tomorrow, eh?
Yeah, we're flying out to Boston tomorrow morning.
Okay. And when's the wedding?
The 20th.
All right. So you've got a bit of a holiday as well, have you?
Yeah, we're there until the Hogmanay.
Right. Good. I also wanted to thank you, Mike, for your help with the podcast. I don't know if you remember 2-3 years ago when I started them, I couldn't quite work out how to get them on iTunes and stuff. And you set it all up for me, and it works perfectly every time. So I appreciated that, and thanks for your help with these.
No problem.
Yeah. So once again, thank you very much for tonight, and I've really enjoyed this. It's been interesting to get your thoughts on these different things. Congratulations again on this year, and particularly the Hill. And we look forward to seeing what you're doing next year.
Thank you very much.
Well, I hope you enjoyed that interview with Mike Raffan. Mike, as I said, has had a great year this year. And so it was really interesting to hear about how he trained and how things have gone, and particularly the Hill race over this past weekend. So thanks for listening. There will be another podcast in another couple of weeks when I've lined somebody up. And I thought I'd finish, as I have been doing for the last wee while, with a quote from Wombat Fitness. And I thought this one fitted in quite well, really, with what we've been chatting about with Mike. And this is Tim Noakes, a professor, a runner of more than 70 marathon and ultra-marathon events, and the author of several books. And he said this: your body will argue that there is no justifiable reason to continue. Your only recourse is to call on your spirit, which fortunately functions independently of logic.